Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
All right, everyone, welcome. Hi, Mom. Thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And to my left is my loyal sidekick and fellow film enthusiast, Gabe Haggard. Gabe, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself to the people?
Hello, my name is Gabe Haggard. Thank you for listening to all our devoted fans. It's really meant a lot to us to have you with us every step of the way on our first podcast.
Yes, I forgot to mention it is our inaugural edition.
We appreciate your loyalty.
Yes, yes. For sticking with us for the 5 second opener. I know it's rough going, but it's smooth sailing from here on out.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe we should just jump right into it.
Yeah,
before
you think?
Too many more people turn off their radios.
All right, well, all right, before we jump right in, we have a special guest on this edition. It's the youngest of the Lampert brood, my little brother, the one and only Lord Lampert. Gary, why don't you hop on the mic and tell people a little bit about yourself?
Well, there have been a lot of big moments in my life, but this has to be tops. I'm just glad to be here and glad to contribute. I hope I can help in some way, but I'm just here to learn. So thank you for having me.
Yeah. Gary, why don't you tell the people about your accolades, film-wise?
Well, when I was 14, I was an extra on Seventh Heaven. Then I was also on a show called Ned. And that's when I retired, hung up the Spurs.
Okay, so you're kind of an old-timer here.
That's right.
Seasoned pro.
We appreciate you coming out of retirement to spend some time with us.
And I believe there was a film studies class in college, Gar?
That's right, Pauline. I took film 125. I would say I'm an expert, and I am. But in addition, so I feel that gave me the vocabulary to discuss the subject. And I've watched a lot of films, and I might have learned a thing or two from my big sister. But aww. Yes, film 125 at Vanderbilt University.
So how does that work? You just film 101, you're just able to skip past that, you don't really need to concentrate on that?
Well, I had watched films. So they felt that was unnecessary.
He'd seen Citizen Kane before.
We didn't actually watch Citizen Kane in that class.
It was assumed you already had.
Right, I guess this was, so there must have been sort of a placement test of snobbery, and I had passed with flying colors.
Nice. So speaking of Citizen Kane, we would like to introduce a segment we're calling So You Call Yourself a Film Snob. In this segment, we plan to go through the entire sight and sound list of the greatest movies of all time. And I think we'll introduce each movie the week before. And as we go through, we have to cop to whether or not we've actually seen these movies. These lists come out every 10 years. And in 2012, Citizen Kane lost the throne. It had held this title as the greatest movie of all time for five consecutive lists, so about 50 years. And it was replaced by Vertigo. But because I personally feel, I don't know how Gabe feels about this, but I personally feel that Citizen Kane was unfairly dethroned. We're going to start with Citizen Kane.
I mean, it's a little disingenuous when you say that we're going to go through the entire catalog when on our inaugural podcast we skipped the number one movie. But I am with you that I feel as though Citizen Kane is a far superior film to Vertigo. But we can get to that at a later date.
All right, that'll be on next week's podcast. You wait, we're going to take down Vertigo.
I'm ready.
All right. But in the meantime, so Citizen Kane, directed by Orson Welles, made in 1941. Basically what it's about is it follows the life of a newspaper magnate whose famous last words are Rosebud. And it follows a newspaper reporter trying to dig up the story of Rosebud and what the significance of Rosebud is. And through this journey, we sort of parcel together a picture of this man, Charles Foster Kane, and how he grew into basically an isolated, lonely, deranged billionaire, millionaire, wealthy dude. So, yeah.
And much fun was had by all.
Absolutely. This is a laugh riot. But, all right, so let's get into it. Gabe, what does Rosebud mean to you?
Well, as the line towards the end of the film, I think in the last scene, the last, like, big, long tracking shot of Xanadu with all his belongings going up in flames, the reporter or some dude asks, can a man's life be summed up in one word? And that word, of course, in Citizen Kane is Rosebud. And so what I think that means is that embodies the love that Kane never had his entire life and for which he was searching his entire life to attain or to receive, really. He feels that with all his money and power, he's going to be able to force the world, basically, to love him, and he is sadly mistaken.
So what do you think about the claim that Rosebud is, yes, it's symbolic, but when I watch the movie, I think of the line just prior to, I think it's the last line in the movie where the reporter says to his colleagues, I don't think it would have explained the man. I think that's just another piece of the puzzle. So how much do you think Rosebud really sums up the movie? How important do you think it is to the overall theme of the movie?
I mean, I think that may be a good line, that, you know, that's a telling line, that it's just a piece of the puzzle. Because obviously, again, like I was saying, in his search for love, Rosebud sort of personifies that, or sort of is merely a symbol of that. But what I think is going on within Kane is, you know, obviously a much deeper seated thing. It's not just about the sled. You know, it's about the fact that his mother never loved him, and so at a young age, he was incredibly scarred by that, by not receiving the proper love that he should have from his mother, and then he carries that with him throughout his entire life. And I think the point in the film when the love becomes out of reach, when it becomes untenable for him, when basically he starts his downward spiral into not being able to achieve that love, is in the scene when he's being blackmailed by, I believe, Getty, his opponent.
Boss Jim Gettys.
Yes, when he's being blackmailed, and so he comes out of the theater, and his wife is waiting in a taxi, and he says, where are we going? And they go to Susan's apartment, and Gettys is there, and then Kane gets furious, because up till that point, he had done some, you know, unadvisable things, but he hadn't really, he hadn't really even cheated on his wife yet. He had just maybe spent an ill-advised evening,
or maybe several ill-advised evenings. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. But I got the feeling that he hadn't really done anything that bad yet.
Right. It could have been, you know, this was made in 1941. The censors probably wouldn't have allowed it. So he just maybe threw it in there like, no, we didn't actually do anything. But maybe not. Maybe it was totally innocent.
Yeah. And that's sort of my theory, is that nothing too bad had happened yet. And then at the end of that scene, when his current wife walks out the door and she stops in the doorway and turns around and asks him if he's coming. And then he lets his pride get in the way. And he says, no, I'm not coming, because he's furious with the fact that Getty is blackmailing him, and he refuses to kind of go along with it and return with his wife, mm-hmm. who it seemed to me at that point is still willing to, you know, give him a second shot, give him another try or whatnot. She seemed to still be willing to work on their relationship. And so when he refuses to go with her, I see that as the turning point mm-hmm. as to whether or not he will ever receive love.
Mm-hmm. Well, was he ever capable of love? I mean, I think the movie would have us believe that no, that the separation from his mother in the beginning of the movie sort of he sought love but was forever unable to give love or didn't trust other people enough to love them. But it's also interesting, I wanted to point out, to what extent can we trust each individual narrative? I was talking with Gary about this last night. So initially we get Thatcher's point of view, then we get Jed Leland's, then we get Bernstein's, and then we get Jed Leland's, and then we get Susan Alexander's, and then finally the butler. And each come with their own unique perspective. And I think Wells does a really great job portraying each story very differently. And they're very, very different. So, you know, Thatcher sees him as a young punk, essentially. And Bernstein idolizes him. So in the Thatcher portrayal, he does, you know, a lot of really reckless things. In the Bernstein portrayal, he does a lot of, you know, even his sort of impulsive things he does, or like the whimsical things, like buying lots of statues. Even that's like, isn't he great? You know, like it's clearly very positive portrayal. And then when Jed starts talking about him, he's clearly very bitter. You know, he fired him, and so that whole segment is filtered through that, you know, lens. And then finally Susan Alexander, she's clearly terrified of him, and not only is her story terrifying, but the movie, that whole section is scary. I think, you know, he seems grotesque. So I wondered, to what extent do we really know Kane at the end at all? Gary, got any thoughts?
It's certainly true that the narrators are unreliable at some points, but I don't know, I just view that more as a way of telling the story, because Wells was interested in different ways of doing it.
And sort of, again, the each progression or each way that he is viewed, as Gary was pointing out, is sort of a progression into, you know, ultimately into insanity, or ultimately to death. Mm-hmm. So I think in a way that still fits with you know, my desire to focus on that one point as sort of the turning point in Kane as a character, you know, and so as to whether or not he, you know, was ever capable of love, I like the quote from Kane, I think is during the first set of flashbacks, when he says, if I had not been very wealthy, I could have been a great man. Mm-hmm. So I think that's like in a way meant to like allude to the fact that he was very dynamic. He had a lot going for him, mm-hmm. you know, and he, in a way he could have been great, mm-hmm. you know?
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, just to throw a wrench in that, I mean, we see before he finally his wife walks out on him and everything's blown up. His first wife and him, they start to hate each other. They show the progression of the dinner or the breakfast. They see each other only at breakfast. Now, we only hear this from, see that from Leland's perspective, but they certainly don't like each other already then, so.
Yeah, there's certainly, the relationship is deteriorating. And so, while certainly not the linchpin certainly not the only thing that that disrupts or ends their relationship is that moment that I referred to earlier, but I feel like that is the turning point, the tipping point, mm-hmm. as it were. And that's why you sort of begin to pity him at right. that point, because they have had a rocky relationship. But I don't know. I saw that his wife's willingness to, and not to say that she's going to, you know, turn a blind eye and forget about everything, you know, but her willingness, it seemed to me, her willingness to keep trying or to give it another shot or to try to work through it, and that's the point when he, you know, verbalizes essentially that it's over and that his arrogance or his, you know, pride has completely killed it.
Mm-hmm.
Although, as you said, we've already seen through the montage sequence that their relationship has deteriorated, you know, and isn't that strong at all anymore.
It's interesting because I always thought that his relationship with Susan Alexander seemed more real. It seemed, despite the horrible power imbalance, it seemed like he would get more out of that relationship, even though both are pretty toxic. Another thing I wanted to mention, how do you think Orson Welles feels about Charles Foster Kane? When I first saw the movie, I thought he was sort of an idealistic youngster, but he genuinely meant what he said in that initial declaration of principles. I believed that Charles Foster Kane believed what he was saying when he said he wanted to, you know, stick up for the common man, speak for those who don't have a voice. But I was reading, or I'd read in Conversations with Orson Welles, it's like a book that documents a series of conversations that he had with Peter Bogdanovich, that Kane never really meant anything that he was saying. And all of those principles were just a means of getting the world to love him. So obviously, you know, directors don't always know what they're putting out there. But I wonder, to what extent do you guys think that Kane is being disingenuous, or to what extent he actually cares about other people?
Well, he seems to only care about other people to the extent that they are going to love him. And again, going back to what Gary was talking about in terms of a progression, I feel like, you know, who am I to say that Orson Welles is wrong about what Kane actually thinks, but...
What does that dude know anyway? Am I right?
Exactly. And is he a film snob? I don't know. But I feel like maybe, you know, the argument could be made that Kane may have thought he believed it,
mm-hmm.
in the beginning when he writes his initial, you know, declaration.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, and even like the way it's acted and the way the character is portrayed in that beginning, he's sort of bright eyed and bushy tailed, mm-hmm. you know, and he's setting off on this great adventure, and he's kind of, you know, sort of stuck it to Thatcher, and he's going out to do his own thing, going out to conquer the world. But really what he's after from the very beginning is the love that he's never had. And so as things, you know, get progressively worse, and as he does not find love in his various relationships or his, you know, various endeavors, he gets more and more thwarted, more and more frustrated by what's happening around him.
So let's talk about the movie itself. What do you think about, do you think it belongs in the number one position? Do you think that all the accolades that have been bestowed upon it are merited? And yeah, let's start with that.
Well, seeing as this was essentially the first film off a list of 250,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to reserve judgment as to declaring I've seen one of them, and whether or not it deserves to be in the number one spot. you know, I'm going to reserve judgment at least for another week or two.
Okay.
As far as all the accolades that Kane, Citizen Kane, has gotten over the years, I am a firm believer that they're all warranted. I love this movie.
Yeah.
I think this movie is great.
Yeah.
I love what Orson Welles did with the writing, with the directing, with the acting. This movie was so revolutionary at the time. And what I love about it is it still stands up today. And, you know, yes, there are, you know, antiquated aspects of it. Like, oh, well, people don't really talk like that anymore. Mm-hmm. That's a little silly, or that's a little old-timey, you know. But the story is still so compelling. You know, the decline and fall of a pseudo-great man. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so compelling at its core that, you know, I think that's one of the biggest reasons why it's been such a success and why everybody loves it.
So there you have it, guys. Citizen Kane, thumbs up all around. Gare, what do you think?
Well, obviously, it's an outstanding movie. I mean, I have trouble with these lists because I never know what they mean.
What makes something number one? What makes something better than another thing?
Yeah, I mean, so does it mean, you know, every person who's going to go watch it is more likely than any other movie to enjoy that movie more than any other movie? I'm not sure what it means. Usually these lists mean some sort of influence or something, an impact on the field. I was thinking about this earlier. I watched it, I think I've seen it 3 or 4 times now. I think the last time I saw it, that was the best impression of it I've had. It improved my mind, possibly because I've learned more about film. It's just how rich it is, and like how hard he's working on every scene with the camera and the lighting, and they don't take a scene off. Everything is just on point.
Yeah.
Do we exaggerate how much it's influencing the feel?
I think it's more that Orson Welles had this, you know, iconoclastic attitude towards filmmaking, and I think that's the real influence over time. You know, that this medium could be messed with a little bit. You know, that you don't have to stick to the script, so to speak. You can hire a cinematographer who's willing to just go with the flow. And yeah, we're going to break the 180-degree line. You know, what are you going to do about it? And we're going to make it work. We're going to shoot in the floor because that's what we're going to do. So I think it's more the approach he took to filmmaking that's really the most influential aspect. I'm sure many films since have used the you know, the deep depth of field, the nonlinear approach to storytelling. And that, I mean, also, we don't want to take that for granted at all. But I do think that the primary influence he's had is in his attitude. And I don't know that his biggest influencers were necessarily the Hollywood system. The esteem for these films really came, you know, a little bit later. The full impact of what he'd done, I think, really hit with, especially the French New Wave guys. They're like, what is this? So I think that's really what it's about.
That's true. Though we did replace Vertigo with this.
That's true. And
Vertigo has a similarly growing influence over time. So, but I mean, I don't want to steal from future podcasts.
Well, I guess we'll find out, huh? Stay tuned.
Again, your humility is appreciated.
All right. On that note, let's move on to our next topic. So, next topic. Seeing as how you guys out there probably don't know very much about us, unless, of course, your family members, which, seeing as how we're nobody, you probably are. But just in case, we thought we'd compile a list of our top 5 movies. So we're already on our way. We got to think for lists over here at FlixWise. So, Gary, do you wanna start?
Golly, this is a lot of pressure.
We let our guests go first.
Fair enough. So, I mean, as I mentioned when we discussed Citizen Kane, I'm not quite sure what these lists mean. So what it means for one to be ranked among another. So what I did, my top 5, ranked in no particular order at this point.
Cheater.
Okay, well, I have a firm number 1.
Okay, all right. Firm Wait, one. Okay, do we want to start? I'm going to take a poll. Start at number 5 or number 1?
Let's start at number one. Start. Go big or go home.
All right, let's do it.
Okay. So, but I went with variety for my list. But number one is without equal, often imitated, never quite duplicated, would be Airplane.
Excellent choice. Excellent.
The greatest spoof of all time. For those lovers of puns out there, high comedy, that is. Elevated humor.
And boobs.
And gratuitous nudity. There's nothing better. I look forward to discussion about this, but no real challenges.
Well, I think we're done here.
So are we going to discuss for a while? Or is your number one sort of takes care of your entire top five? Or...
Well, Garrett, let me ask you. Have you ever seen a movie about gladiators?
Blaine, that question makes me uncomfortable.
What do you like about Airplane? It seems like a stupid question, because what's not to like, really?
I mean, you know, I've seen many interviews with Siskel and Ebert when they reviewed films, and they always said comedies are much easier to review, because there's just one question, doesn't make you laugh. Now, I have to say, I have seen it so many times now that I do not laugh at all the jokes anymore.
Okay.
But it makes me laugh hard. Now, it, you know, compare Airplane to Citizen Kane. You know, it's an interesting...
Which is the greater cinematic achievement? I do think we need to talk about that for sure. Right. Yeah.
Well, I would posit that Airplane is something other than a film.
Mm.
As you mentioned, it is a spoof of a film,
mm-hmm.
of many films. It itself is not a film.
Oh, I disagree. It is. I'm being very serious when I say it is a staggering achievement. It is a great, great film.
How did we get here? So, One minute we're talking about the epitome of filmmaking.
Okay, well, I think, can we all agree, Airplane, excellent movie. Can we all agree? Well, you can't even agree that it's a movie, so maybe not. All right.
He said it wasn't a film.
Not a film, okay.
I can neither affirm nor deny your statement.
Okay, done. Number two, Gary.
Number two. So this one, I switched it up, and we have a Best Picture winner. Just to clarify, we're going with favorite movies.
Favorite movies, okay.
Number two, 1992 Best Picture winner, Unforgiven. Now, I'm a big fan of Westerns, so Unforgiven, once you've seen a lot of Westerns, the way it challenges your images of the Western and violence in film in general, I don't know if I should offer a full synopsis of the plot or full description. But,
give us one sentence.
One sentence. Well, without the plot, it's old outlaws trying to do what they had done many years before and discovering it's much more difficult than they thought. But what truly makes that great is the way they add, it's cinematic realism, where it's very difficult to kill people unless you're a very bad person and people nearly die of a cold. The way the West would be, but not as it's usually depicted in the movie. So that is my second favorite movie of all time. Plus, outstanding Clint Eastwood and Gene Hackman performances.
Yeah, I love Gene Hackman. I can watch him in pretty much anything. So, and I think that's a really good choice, Garrett. Like, I'm shocked. Like, to go, well, no, I mean, to go from, I mean, we had Airplane.
I think we've moved on. Yeah. We're not talking about Airplane. Okay. We've moved on to number two. You know? Let's just enjoy this.
Yeah.
Live in the moment.
Yeah. No, I mean, I love the sort of meta commentary about, you know, the way it deals, like the way Hollywood has dealt with Westerns in the past and how it sort of revisits some of the old legendary characters and what you said about it being really hard to kill people unless you're a really evil person. I think that's really, really apt. And yeah, I mean, that's a beautiful movie. Absolutely. So, number three.
So, keeping with the theme of variety, I chose the greatest all-time dumb action movie, Die Hard. Bruce Willis, renegade cop. Well, not quite renegade cop, just cop on a vacation, saving the Nakatomi Plaza. Who could object?
From Alan Rickman, lest we forget.
Noble trust.
Absolutely. Also want to mention Die Hard, one of the greatest Christmas movies of all time.
Well, I'm sure this will spoil a lot, but there's more where that came from.
Next on the list, number four.
Number four, I have the 1954 Best Picture winner, On the Waterfront, starring Marlon Brando. So, I mean, there's not much to describe about it, just a great movie about learning to stand up for what's right. Kind of pro-McCarthy message, but that's okay. We'll put that behind us. Or at least pro-HUAC. Well acted. Obviously, no one needs to describe Brando's performance in that. It's already legendary. But even the direction, the Leonard Bernstein soundtrack is really outstanding. Lots of energy. Carl Malden.
Even Mary Saint.
So that would be number four on my list.
Very good. Nice. Ily Kazan.
I approve this message.
All right. That's obviously a standout. Can you give us your best Marlon Brando impression, Gary? Tell the listeners. Gary, what do you think about your brother? Put you on the spot.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender.
You sound like Woody Allen.
Maybe better with the Godfather era. Brando.
Thank you. Thank you for that moving rendition.
All right. And on that note, number five.
Well, it was foreshadowed before, but It's a Wonderful Life.
All right.
Very moving Jimmy Stewart, Frank Capra movie. So, gets me, even as the Jew I am, really in the Christmas spirit.
Do you cry? You cry, right?
I've never cried to a movie, but that gets
You've
me.
Never cried ever.
I never cried. I would cry, but the steel and the tear ducts prevent it. But it gets me as close as any movie does.
Yeah, I feel like that's one of those movies that you see, and not you don't forget how good it is, but I tend to forget how much I'm going to enjoy it every time that I watch it again. You know, there are films that you're like, oh, I love that film, but then you watch it again, and even like the really good ones, you can be like, oh yeah, it's great, you know, and you still recognize its greatness. But I feel like It's a Wonderful Life is one of those that you watch and you enjoy, you know, over and over again.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. And I'll talk more about that when we get to my list.
Another excellent segue. Yes. Pauline, would you like to share your list?
Okay, so my number one pick is All About Eve, 1951, directed by Joseph L. Mankiewicz. But we just had a whole episode full of Mankiewicz. Am I right? The nephew of Herman, I believe. But it's the standout here is Miss Betty Davis, being her awesome Miss Betty Davis self. The tagline for the movie, I think, is it's a movie about two women and their men, which couldn't be a less apt description. I don't understand where that came from at all. But it's essentially about two dueling stage divas, and one's getting up there in age and is really insecure about it, and one is a young up-and-comer who sort of weasels her way into Miss Margot Channing's, that would be Betty Davis's, inner circle and tries to take over. And much cattiness ensues. I feel like I'm being sort of, you know, a little bit flippant, but this movie, it's really funny and it's really well-written, and I don't know, it's something about, you know, Margot's coming to terms with her age and what it's like to be a woman, you know, in that business. And I don't know, it just I always find it really moving as well as really, really funny. So, yeah.
Excellent choice.
Thank you. Thank you. Gary, any thoughts?
Well, if you had watched, you listeners out there have watched the Jungle Book and thought, I can't get enough Shere Khan. This is your movie. But in addition, I don't want to spoil the plot too much, but great story of comeuppance. Mm-hmm. You know, it all comes back around.
True, true. All right, number two, The Apartment, 1960, directed by Billy Wilder. I really could have just filled this list with Billy Wilder movies. In fact, I probably should have. But, I don't know, in the service of variety, I decided to just name my absolute favorite. This movie stars Shirley MacLaine, Jack Lemmon, and it's about two lonely people living in New York trying to get by, essentially. And it's the romantic comedy template for the ages. Like, every single romantic comedy has in some way tried to capture the spirit of this movie. It's really funny, but it's also really cynical, and it, you know, Billy Wilder just gets me, I guess. He gets me. Also, on another note, it's sort of where the inspiration for the title of this podcast came from. So, and those of you who have seen it know what I'm talking about. Those of you who haven't should definitely go out and watch it. Yeah. So, number three, Cabaret, 1972, Bob Fosse. I just want to say, for the record, it was robbed. Totally should have beat The Godfather for Best Picture. Yes. Yes.
I'll stop you right there. Fine. I know kind of the whole point of this flicks-wise.
Sorry. Yeah. Is flicks-wise, Gabe.
Is that we're, you know, we think of ourselves as film snobs. So far, I have not seen one of your list.
Cool.
I have not seen any of these films on your list. However, that will not stop me from commenting as to whether or not the film should or should not have ousted The Godfather to win anything. I strongly disagree. Okay. However, since I have not seen your film, I will reserve judgment.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's got songs. It's got really good songs. It's got Liza Minnelli being awesome and cute and adorable. I know we all think of her as either crazy or Lucille too, but she was, in fact, totally, totally adorable in this movie. And it's got Nazis. What more could you ask for? Am I right?
The mafia, guns, Al Pacino.
There are guns, though. Don't you worry.
Yeah, it was just the way you started that, you know, it's got singing and dancing. That's
and Nazis.
That's not just like some sort of trump card. You pull out the Nazis. That's generally something that people don't like.
Yeah, well,
that's not one of those things. Oh, and the best part is, somebody's invading Poland, and the best part is, they're Nazis. It's like, what is that? Oh, we've been in the cellar for 3 weeks, and who's at the door? Nazis. That's not...
Well, in this case, it serves the movie really well. What you could...
Oh, those kind of Nazis.
Those Nazis, yeah, the fun kind. But, I mean, basically, I think of it, the experience within the Kit Kat Club as being something of a parable about, you know, the rise of, Nazism in the, or it sort of mirrors the rise, maybe not a parable, but it mirrors the rise of Nazism in, you know, Weimar Germany. And it tells this story through this lounge. I guess she's not a lounge. She's a cabaret singer. And I mean, great. The cinematography is beautiful, and it's just really, like, kinetic and fun to watch, and the storytelling's really, really good, and Liza's great in it.
as someone who has seen Cabaret, it should not
let's
have,
not gang up on Cabaret.
it is a very enjoyable film. It should not have defeated The Godfather.
I'm so gonna edit that out. Number four. Here's one neither of you have seen, I'm sure. Wild Strawberries, Ingmar Bergman, 1957. Swedish. It's got subtitles. But it's also about an old man who is looking back upon his life while he's embarking on a road trip with his son's fiance. And it's basically about him coming to terms with all the negativity he's always held on to throughout his life has really impacted his son, and it has impacted his relationship with his son. Something about like the father-daughter relationship that he cultivates through the course of this trip. But I don't know, I related. So thoughts, guys?
No.
All right, another one. This one's 8.5. Federico Fellini, 1963. This one, I think, Gabe, you were mentioning how there are some movies that you should like and you watch them and you appreciate them, and others you love and you know, you can invest feeling in them. This one, I related to this movie so much as an aspiring film student. It's basically about a very famous movie director who's struggling to come up with an idea for his next movie. And he's got, you know, producers on his back and actresses bugging him and everyone, you know, meanwhile, he's got all this personal drama about, you know, he's got this mistress and this wife. And I don't know, something about it's essentially about feeling anxious about the creative process. And that was something I could really, really relate to and still can. And it's I appreciate all the surreal touches and obviously highly influential. But it's funny, the last time I watched it, I didn't have as an emotional reaction to it. I don't know what it was, if I was taken out of the movie because of all the really blatant sexism. And he totally owns it. I mean, he's a pig and he knows it. But for whatever reason, the last time I watched it, I guess it was this year, I found it sort of off-putting. So this used to be my number two slot, so I dropped it down a few slots. But yeah, so there's an example of something that I appreciate now more than emotionally relate to, I guess. So yeah, any thoughts?
Well, I've only seen 8.5 once. I have to say, I thought it was a good movie. I was actually, it's hard for me to remember my initial reaction. I remember thinking I didn't enjoy it as much as I thought I would. Though people have told me it takes repeated watching. Mm. So, I don't know.
I've seen half.
Of 8.5, all right.
4.25.
Okay, so on that note, Gabe, give us your top five.
Okay, at the top of my list is a film that I enjoy and appreciate.
Okay.
It is Casablanca.
Okay.
And the main reason why I love it so much is I love the screenplay and I love the screenwriting.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like every scene in that movie is like a masterclass of how a screenplay should be written.
Mm-hmm.
And Humphrey Bogart's really cool.
He can rock that white suit, am I right? It's absolutely a masterclass in screenwriting and direction. I mean, Michael Curtiz, he was sort of like the go-to guy for these sorts of movies. Like, he was just like a Hollywood, someone like not necessarily considered an auteur, but, you know, someone that the studios kept in their back pocket and they knew he could do a competent job. But I think that's really not giving him enough credit because I think every scene is so well shot. I mean, I love that intro where we first see Humphrey Bogart in the movie. I think it's so well done. He's so cool. You know, Humphrey Bogart was like a tiny, tiny man, but something about the way it's shot, he looks so, you know, he looks larger than life.
Yeah, an outstanding and very moving movie. It's very moving, despite the fact that the core of the plot really makes no sense. And that's to its credit. But just, I think of the acting, I mean, particularly, I think Claude Rains steals the show.
Probably.
And just for the banter between Claude Rains and Humphrey Bogart, it makes it worth the price of admission.
And there are Nazis.
The good kind of Nazis, right?
Yes.
The good kind.
Yes.
Number two on my list, you may be familiar with from such things as FlixWise podcast episode one, and that would be Citizen Kane.
All right, someone put Citizen Kane on their list. I'm so happy.
And yeah, just because of all the things I mentioned before, it's a cool movie. Moving right along to number three. And again, I am kind of in the same boat as Gary with these lists. Mm. Kind of being a very, very hard thing to nail down. Mm-hmm. So what I have next is The Bridge on the River Kwai.
I love that movie.
And yeah, and that's mostly why, because I love it. And so number four, I think that's where we are. Number four would be The Third Man.
Nice.
And again, just because it's really cool. Yeah, I just really enjoy
it. Yeah, that's actually in my top 10 list, so there you go.
Rounding out the top five would be the one that appears on Gary's list as well. Airplane, just kidding. It's a Wonderful Life.
Okay.
Because it's wonderful.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Capra fans in the house. It's cool. I too love that movie. It makes me cry every time.
Just one comment about It's a Wonderful Life for listeners who, you know, may not have seen it or just know the impression of it, that it's just kind of mush for the stomach. Most of it, people forget, it's a really dark, kind of unsettling movie. And then it's only one piece of it that's often repeated, often satired, that where we get, you know, what it's known for. But it's just well made all around. And Jimmy Stewart in that, one of the best acting performances ever.
I agree.
Cool. All right. And that's our top five. I hope you found something on there to agree with. If you are a Pearl Harbor fan, I guess you're just out of luck. In fact, you know, maybe someday Michael Bay will enter into one of our lists. But
I think the greatest movie-going experience you will ever have is when the lights come down and it says, Jerry Bruckheimer presents a Michael Bay film.
It's how you know it's going to be good. On to our next subject.
Carriage, return.
Okay, so for the final segment of our podcast, we just want to give you a little heads up. You're dealing with a couple of negative Nancys. We tend to not like things or find reasons not to like things. Is that fair?
Yeah, most of the time, if there are things that we watch, we don't like them.
So in this segment, we just want to end on a sort of a positive note. One thing that we liked. Gabe, go ahead.
Okay, one thing that I really enjoyed this week, and I happened to go to the theater on two separate occasions, and I was lucky enough to see this trailer on two separate occasions. It's a trailer for the Samurai film coming out, starring Keanu Reeves, 47 Ronin. That trailer has given me so much joy in the past week.
That's an excellent, excellent choice for sure. Let's see. One thing that I've enjoyed, I just recently finished Star Trek. I've been on a Star Trek Next Generation binge marathon, and I recently completed it. And seeing as how it's the most recent one that I've watched, I'm going to go with the series finale, All Good Things. It's probably among the greatest series finales I've ever seen.
So would you characterize yourself as a Trekkie or a Star Wars fan?
I, up until finishing Star Trek Next Generation, unequivocally Star Wars fan. And still, to a certain extent, very much a Star Wars fan. But I don't think the two are mutually exclusive. So
you believe that there is a universe in which they can coexist?
Yes, I think so.
Do you think that J.J. Abrams is going to try to make like some Star Wars cameos in his Star Trek? Is he going to try? I mean, he's already, let's face it, he's already destroyed the Star Trek universe.
Yeah.
Okay. There's parallel timelines and they're younger. It's already a disaster.
Yeah.
And he himself has admitted that he is not a Star Trek fan.
Right, right. Yeah.
And now we have that guy also creating the new Star Wars.
Yeah, so he can muck that up too. We're all really excited. This is like a great forum for shit talking, but I just want to be clear, JJ, if you need a writer's assistant or anything, you give me a shout. I'm not saying anything negative about JJ Abrams. Yes, I am on a later show.
JJ? you don't know where I live, but I'm just saying that I don't, you know, maybe it's not your fault. Maybe you had a poor upbringing. I don't know. I don't want to point fingers, but I don't like what you're doing to all of the space-related franchises of my childhood.
Fair enough.
I just want to say I'm very excited about this, the fourth Star Wars movie ever made.
True dat, true dat. Yeah, indeed. I think we can all breathe a heavy sigh of relief that George Lucas will never, ever make any Star Wars prequels. We really dodged a bullet.
On that note, we'd like to say thank you and goodbye.
Yeah. All right, so that was our maiden voyage of the FlixWise podcast. I hope you'll tune in next time where we will be discussing Vertigo. So feel free to follow along. Thanks.
Thank you.
News on the march.
Exactly.
That's how it went.
Yes, that's exactly how it went. That's very good.
Yeah.